Yeah. Well, thanks, Ryan. They mean business about those forms, don't they? Anytime you get called out, better get that done. So I lost a third of the audience here. So, well, this is fun. How's that? How's the sound in the back? Am I doing pretty good? Volume good? Okay, great. Thanks. So, well, you know, a little piece of bookkeeping. Somebody asked me this. On the back, I did bring a couple of copies of some of my books, and then you'll see the sign that has a QR code on it. That'll take you right to Amazon. And rather than lugging boxes of books all around the place, as my son said, well, don't you want to catch people on impulse buying? So you could just, you know how it is, connect with that QR code, and it will take you to Amazon, and if you can order books to your delight there. So thank you. All right. Well, we are talking about walking with me, and one of the little things I've thought about in walking with people that should be encouraging to all of us is that, some of us, we're good to walk up to mile marker number 3, right? And if you picture that mile marker is might be where you are in terms of your maturity in Christ and your experience in Christ. And so you could take anybody up to mile marker number 3, right? I can help anybody that's in mile marker 1 and 2 and bring them out to mile marker 3. But then if I feel like, man, I just don't have the experience there, the depth, whatever it is, but I've got some friends who are at 4, 5, and 6. And that's why it's good to remember that disciple making is sometimes we kind of picture it as a singles match. It's just me and this other person. Well, I like to picture it as a team sport. And that's why we need the body of Christ. And so there are people out here in this room that are a mile marker 5, 6, 7, and 8. And if I'm only at mile marker 3 and 4, boy, how can I connect people with those who are walking ahead of me in that way? And so I don't feel like I'm the only one in this. And if they don't learn it or hear it from me, they're never going to get it. Well, no, this is a team sport. And that's, hey, I'm good up to mile marker 3. That's great. Somebody else can take them on from there. And that's, again, something using this analogy that it gives us some truths by which we can learn to help other people. So in a previous session, we talked about how we need to walk heart to heart with people. And we talked about we develop our hearts through 3 simple little disciplines, cultivating wonder, being inspired, and then how others, contribute to our life and kind of help our hearts. And to this session, we want to talk about going slow and deep. And I want to, in particular, spend a little more time on deep, but there's elements of slowness, just because we tend not to talk about this subject, that I'd like us to explore. One of the things I've found in life is that, probably like some of you, we are a product of our home life. And my father was a short man, about 5'9", but my dad was if I could not keep up with him and he walked, my dad was always in a hurry and always wanting to get things done, always on the move. Even when he was in his late 80s and early 90s, it's kind of like, it's hard to keep up with dad. And I found that I can be the same way. I'm kind of always moving and can be always in a hurry. And it drives my wife crazy sometimes, so that every morning we try to take a walk around our yard with our dog. And Peggy will want to stop and, hey, did you see what this flower is doing? Or did you notice this bush? And I'm thinking, well, no, I need to get into the house because I got things I got to do. And I'm in a hurry and I'm not stopping and savoring. That's why I probably should have prefaced our discussion last session, is that this is the idea of savoring is something I'm learning to do. It's not anything natural for me at all. And some of you are more of that way, but I've had to really work at it. And so the idea of going slow for me has been a slow experience to learn it in my own life. So let's talk about, that going, we walk slow with people. And life is learning to live with a slow God. And I don't mean that in a negative way, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But life's learning to live with a slow God, but we live in a culture of speed, right? A lot of times for many of us, our production and our measurement of success is given by the amount of things that we're doing, how busy we are, right? And that we often think that person is successful because they're hard to get a hold of because they're so busy. And this is particularly true, by the way, in pastoral settings. But a lot of times, whether we like it or not, congregations can measure the success of their pastors by how busy they are. And we live in this busy and a fast culture. Think of the cell phone, internet connections, and every new iPhone, Apple phone that comes out, it's measured by the speed by which you can connect with something. To me, it's just amazing with Amazon that, at least in Columbus, man, you can now get same-day delivery on certain products. And that's just, this is wild, At least next day and same-day delivery. I found this at the Chinese ideogram, the symbol for busy in Chinese is made up of two characters, heart and killing. So busyness, in a lot of ways, can end up killing our hearts. Do you know that today skimming is a dominant form of reading? So, for example, I've got a blog and talking to the fellow that manages my website, and he's a professional in this. And I said, Mark, hey, does it make any difference how long it is? I always heard you had to have these short blogs. And he said, no, it doesn't make any difference how long it is because people are only going to skim it to look for the key points. So what you want to do is either highlight or number the points because people are skimming it. Don't take the time to read it. The reality is that our neural circuits needed for reading and thinking deeply with sustained concentration are weakening. Now, this is not spoken by an old guy. This is spoken by people who are doing the research out there that how we actually process, how we read and we think, those elements in the brain that's necessary for that to happening are actually weakening. We live in a culture of speed. So let's talk about this for just a minute. How are you experiencing life in this culture of speed? What is speeding up for you these days? Yeah, the passage of time. Time seems to go by fast. Yeah, how are you experiencing this idea of speed in our culture today? Well, I didn't throw the statistic in here, but they predicted in the 1970s that all of us would be working 20-hour work weeks by now because of labor-saving devices and other things. The reality is, for a lot of us, we're working 24/7 because we're tethered to this thing called, a phone. And yes. Research has shown that it has definitely been harmed by speed. And I get to give you a couple of books if you're interested in reading them. In fact, research has been done now, and it's kind of on the New York Times bestseller list. I saw an interview with a guy, a MD, researcher, has documented how the impact of cell phones on teenagers and the relationship between cell phone and the rate of depression, et cetera, that exists today. Now, again, this is a book that's out there. It's legitimate research. You can look at New York Times. And so there's research out there that has shown that that element of speed in a variety of settings has slowed down our ability to think deeply about things. It has good sides and bad sides to it, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll get to that in a minute, okay? We'll come back to that question. Yeah. I don't know if the issue is dumbing down, but the issue is, we'll get to that in a minute, yeah. Any other thoughts on how you're seeing speed affecting us? Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's harder to relax. When I sit down, I think I need to do something, yeah. I mean, it's impacting, and there are good things about speed. I'm really thankful for a whole lot of things. I remember when I was in student ministry back in the 90s when the internet was first introduced. And I could send an email out to 30 people now all at once, and I don't have to physically call each person. I really like that. And so that's just a whole lot of things that speed can contribute and help, but there's also some downsides of speed. So I'm making a case today for, in a sense, slowness and what slowness looks like. And I think of this passage in Psalm 46:10 from the Message translation, where he translated it this way. It says, step out of the traffic, take a long, loving look at me, your high God, above politics, above everything. And sometimes we just need to slow down and step out of the traffic, and life can feel that way, right? It's like I'm in a fast lane sometimes, and how do I step out of that? And that we walk with, and I like this, somebody, the average speed of walking is 3 miles an hour. And there's actually a book out called The 3-Mile-an-Hour God. And so we're walking with God. We're kind of walking with a God who's walking at 3 miles an hour. Now, I don't have time to build a whole case, but let me just give you a couple of illustrations of this. This is fascinating. In Deuteronomy 29 and 30, and I think this should encourage all of us who are involved with people. In Exodus 23, 29 and 30, God is right on the verge of Israel's going in to take the promised land. And starting in verse 28, God says, "And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you." And then he throws this little caveat in. He says, "I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the wild beasts multiply against you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you've increased and possessed the land." So God says, I could drive them out in a year or sooner. I've got the ability to do that. But if I do that, you're not going to be prepared. The wild beasts are going to multiply against you. The land's going to become desolate. So what's he say? Little by little, I'll drive them out before you until you've increased in number and you can possess the land. And again, a lot of us have experienced that both in our own lives, that sometimes it's just little by little, one degree of glory to another that Paul talks about in terms of changing our lives. I'm involved with a group of pastors, actually down in Australia, and that's another whole story. But there are friends from, they're all Pentecostal pastors. And so they're reading my book here, and we're discussing it. And one of the men says, "Well, you know, in some circles, the idea of going slow is not real welcomed." And I like my charismatic friends because there's that element of kind of God is at work right now. He can heal you right now. He could change you right now. You can be filled right now. And yes, he can do all those things. And he's fully capable. And all of us have experienced those things right now at times. But there's also a side of God where he kind of chooses to walk slow. And it was interesting how these men and women, as we talk through this, and they say, yeah, you know, as we look at it both experientially and how God causes growth, sometimes there's a slowness to it. And so we walk sometimes with a 3-mile-per-hour God. So when we invite people to walk with us as we walk with Jesus, we're inviting them to it sometimes a slow journey. Disciple-making is not for those who seek quick results, a series of boxes to check, or guaranteed success. Sometimes it's a slow walk. As you know, David mentioned, my primary ministry these days is I'm involved with churches, helping them to develop disciple-making cultures. And usually the inclination of most church leaders that I meet with is kind of like, we need to have a turnaround and we need it today. What can you do to make a difference within this next year? How can we fill our parking lot now? How can we make disciples now? And I'll say to them, well, you know, one of the things that is always a challenge for me is that I always need to lose a few pounds. And I say that, you know, the weight that I've put on, I did not put that on overnight. It probably took me 10 to 15 years to put this weight on. But we look for quick fix diets that's going to take it away right away. And all medical research shows that if you want to lose weight and sustain weight loss, it's little by little over time. Right, doctors? You know, little by little over time. And it's much about a lifestyle change than it is some quick fad diet that you're going to get. And I said, making disciples is that way. I cannot promise you that what we're going to do is going to increase all these disciples. Because, hey, making disciples is sometimes a slow process. It's sticking with people until they get it. It's kind of like weight loss. We want to lose it all at once, but all the studies show that the quicker the loss, generally the faster I'll put it back on. And it's lifestyle changes that we need to make. And so in your church, there's going to have to be some lifestyle changes that will need to be made. Because, you know, sometimes disciple-making is a slow process. So let me suggest two practices for slow disciple-making. And first one is that, and on your notes, we go slow for excellence. We go slow for excellence. In 1 Corinthians 14, 12, Paul says, if you're going to excel in anything, excel in building up the church. How you build up the church should be something that's done with excellence. In Mark 7, 37, it says that Jesus, and he noticed that he did everything well. There was an excellence about what Jesus did. In Daniel 4, 12, it describes that Daniel's promotion was because he had an excellent spirit within him. Now, excellence is not perfection. And excellence, I like the definition that excellence is doing the best I can with the resources available. It's doing the best that I can with the resources available. I just want to do it well with a spirit of excellence. You know, I picked this up with, here's a quote from, some of you may be reading Oswald Chambers, you know, My Utmost for His Highest. And I like this quote. He says, "We have to be exceptional in ordinary things to be holy in mean streets." Now, mean streets is not mean, but it's mean being ordinary streets, okay? "We have to be exceptional in ordinary things to be holy in mean streets, and this is not learned in 5 minutes." Excellence is not something that we do quickly. Now, in a shaker, if any of you are familiar with the shaker furniture, and some of you may own some shaker furniture pieces, this is their philosophy in shaker furniture. You want to make every product better than it's ever been done before. Make the parts you cannot see as well as the parts you can see. Use only the best of material, even for the most everyday items. Give the same attention to the smallest detail as you do the largest. Design every item you make to last forever. So out of that brief description, what words jump out to you about excellence? What words jump out to you about excellence? Yeah, good. But I'm looking at this definition here, the shaker furniture piece. So out of that description here, just what are a couple of words that just grab your attention? Yes. Yeah, best material for everyday items. Yes, in the back. The parts you cannot see, yes. The smallest detail. Somebody there. You know, I don't know, some of you that, I'm a Mac user, and the story, and actually documented, that when Jobs, you know, designed the first Mac, as it were, that he was as picky about the circuit board as he was the exterior design of the Mac. And so he wanted that circuit board that nobody would see to have an element of beauty to it. And then what he did when they finished the product, and he ran all his production teams into the ground, he had them sign their names, and their names were embossed inside of those Macs. And so he could take it apart, and because he felt that every work of art needs to have the signature of an artist. It's something that's done well. So he was concerned not only for the exterior of, you know, what the computer looked like, but the interior. The circuit board had to be designed as well, something that wasn't seen. You know, my dad, when my dad passed away, this was about 10 years ago, and my dad was a meat cutter all his life and a butcher, and learned his trade on the killing floors down in Shreveport, Louisiana, during the Great Depression. And so he'd been a meat cutter all his life. And as I mentioned earlier, my dad came to faith when he was in the 40s, had a pretty dramatic conversion. And one of the things, and I was a kid, just a teenager at the time, and I noticed over time how my dad was cleaning out this little closet, kind of, you know, it's a little room, but it wasn't much bigger than a good-sized closet off from our dining room. And I just watched my dad clean it out and so on, and what I discovered over time, he created this little study room in there, and he started buying little commentaries, started reading the Bible. And so my dad would spend several hours every week, you know, and again, he was a guy that got up at 4:30 in the morning, worked from about 5:30 and got home about 6 at night, and but then he'd have evenings he'd devote to Bible study. And so when he passed away, I inherited a lot of his notes. And again, my dad led a little Bible study in his neighborhood, you know, his mobile home park, a little Bible study there. You know, he was a Gideon speaker. Do you have any Gideons in the audience? Okay, so he'd speak for the Gideons. Yeah, but again, my dad was a meat cutter all his life. My mom worked in the school cafeteria. But I inherited my dad's notes from his Sunday school lessons and his, other things that from his small group studies. And I inherited his books. And my parents are poor. That was really all I had in their inheritance. But it was really interesting going through my dad's commentaries, how he'd underline things and he'd put notes on the side. I'll never forget this one note. He underlined it and says, "too liberal," and in terms of the author's interpretation. And then I got his notes. Nicely, now again, my dad didn't have a computer, and he wasn't into typewriters, so they're all handwritten, nice and clear. He took his time. And I thought, boy, what a spirit of excellence my father had and how he did things. And nobody hidden away in this little mobile home park up in Norwalk, Ohio. My dad's got a little group of 5 people meeting, and then he's writing out his notes, carefully doing his study, and he's doing it with excellence, right? And so it is with us. How are we discipling people with excellence? And so let me toss that question out just for a minute. is how can a, you know, we have to go slow for excellence. So how can the spirit of excellence, doing the best we can with the resources available, affect how we think about discipling others? How can that spirit of excellence affect how we think about discipling others? Yeah, the what we're doing is it lasts forever. So that's a quote, from Shaker Furniture, made to last forever. So in disciple making, our investment is going to be something that's going to last forever. Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what makes it last forever, doesn't it? Anybody else? Excellence. How's it come to bear? Yes. Yeah, and my dad was very intentional. You know, he moved the stuff out of that little room. He intentionally bought books, and he intentionally invested his time. By the way, this is... I'll address it just for a second here, because some people say, well, we want to make sure that disciple making is organic. That's kind of the hot word these days. So, okay, so my wife's a certified master gardener, and the organic gardeners I know are the most disciplined and intentional people I know. They're not allowing gardening to be a haphazard. Oh, I wonder what's going to work this year. Oh, we'll try that. You know, they're the most disciplined and focused people that I know. And so when we use the word organic, let's not use it in a haphazard, unintentional manner, because that's not characteristic at all. But it speaks to some other qualities. But it's speaking to do it with excellence, again. And so as we think about, you know, excellence and disciple, and we have to go slow to do it right, right? So one aspect of two practices of slow disciple making, one is we want to go slow for excellence, and the second is we want to go slow to love. We want to go slow to love. And let me approach this from a different angle. Anybody here familiar with he's actually an author, poet, novelist, essayist, Wendell Berry. Anybody here, Wendell Berry? Okay. And he's also a farmer down in Kentucky. I tried to see him this last spring. He just celebrated his 90th birthday. And so he'd be part of what you'd consider an agrarian philosopher. But he's a distinguished author, poet, etc. But he writes, a lot of his books is about farming and about growing stuff. And he makes this simple statement. He makes a couple of statements here. Let me just quote. It's on your notes. Successful farming starts with a simple act, and he calls it you walk the land. The gait most congenial to agrarian thought and sensibility is walking. It's a gait best suited to paying attention and most permissive of stopping to look or think. All right, again, next statement, he's got a little tongue-in-cheek here. He says, machines, companies, and politicians run. But if we're going to go walk and we're going to go slow, good farmers have a sense of slowness about them. So slowness is a virtue to farming. He or she knows that as speed increases, sometimes care declines. The faster we go, the less we see. As speed increases, care declines. This is why love is first patient. By the way, that should be 1 Corinthians 13:8. I got a typo there. A farmer doesn't look only to enjoy the scenery, but to study the land in order to care. By caring, the farm will furnish. And isn't this true of people? That we take time to care, to love your spouse, to love your children, to love the people you're discipling. It means we've got to slow down and notice some things about them. You know, there's a popular book out, maybe some of you read it, The Five Love Languages, right? In terms of husband and wife. And so I'm taking time to slow down to realize what's the love language of my spouse. And in some ways, what is it that grabs the attention of the man or the woman that I'm discipling, which means I have to slow down to care. You know, one point in my time with the Navigators, I had a responsibility to prepare some men for leadership. So I had my curriculum all made out. I had my goals, had my notebook, right? All those things that are important. And so I'm taking the guys through it. And I realized after about 3 months that, this isn't going over real well. There's not much change happening here. And I began to think about why isn't change happening? There's a variety of reasons. But one of the things I thought about was, one of the guys' name was Tom. And I thought, you know, what motivates Tom? Well, what motivates Tom is he had a graduate degree in history. Tom is the kind of guy that, hey, Tom, here's 5 books to read on this topic. Why don't you read them and then come back and report on them to me? And he just loved doing that. Another guy named Steve. Steve actually had a job, a major responsibility in a major department store. But Steve thrived on responsibility and challenge. So it's kind of like, see the largest dormitory on campus, Steve. go get it. And he's the kind of guy that'd go after him. And then there was Dave. And I thought about what motivates Dave. And I thought, Dave just wants to be my buddy. He's a guy that volunteered to come over on the weekends, babysit my kids, you know, help me do some odd jobs, play basketball with me. He just wanted to be a buddy. And I thought, all three of these men are motivated by different things. And I can't expect them all to respond in the same way because they're just kind of wired a little differently. So I had to slow down to take a look. And to care for them, I had to go slow. And that's what I thought about, you know, again, the first quality of love is patience. And so we have to go slow. Going slow requires us to be patient. And so that, you know, as we think of discipling people in the same way that, you know, God has a sense of breaking through, he's fully able to do that. But a lot of times there's a slowness involved over a period of time, and we can see it in our own lives. And so it is with disciple making. My mentor used to say that disciple making is sticking with people until they get it. That sometimes means going slow. And so I have to go slow, first of all, to do it with excellence, and then to go slow in loving people. So real quickly, is how would you see slowness being applied in the disciple-making experience? Just a couple of quick thoughts. I realize I'm asking you to respond kind of quickly to a fairly deep question, but how can slowness affect how we think about making disciples? Yeah, in other words, it helps me not to think too far ahead, but to take people kind of right where they are right now. Yeah. Yeah, don't want to go quickly over, right? I want to take the time to, here's some areas that we need growth in and help in, and let's take the time to address that. Yeah, anybody else? Yeah. And again, I'm going fast today, and some of you are tracking with me as I go fast. You know, if we were talking about this 1-to-1, 1-to-2, hey, you know, we'd have a whole lot more time to talk about it. And so that then I could ask you questions and we could interact on it. And even for that to happen means we have to slow down, don't we? Even by my stopping to ask you questions, I've got to slow down on my verbal delivery. You see the picture? You know that, again, as we walk next to people, let's not always be in a hurry. You know, let's stick with them until they get it. Let's do it well and to do it with care, that sometimes we have to slow down to really care for people, don't we? All right, the next one. We want to look at the need for depth and going deep with people. And let me share a bit of a personal story that I mentioned earlier about our grandchildren being born premature and my son and daughter, you know, having to commute basically for 6 months to the, you know, to the hospital to care for their children. And if some of you have been familiar with preemies, that when they're in the hospital, they've got all these little monitors, you know, tied to them. And so I remember sitting there one time watching my son and daughter, and of course all the little red lights going on and off, right, indicating something is amiss here. Some of them signals for a nurse to come in, and I said, well, Ryan, what's going on? And he'd been there long enough, he's not panicking. He said, well, this is what's happening now. And I'm kind of panicking as a granddad, because anytime you see a red light blinking, this is not a good deal. And Peggy and I, you know, and they were in Colorado Springs, we're in Columbus, we went back and forth to some degree, but, you know, we also didn't want to be a huge burden to them by being on the scene, but that was a hard time for all of us as a family. And I mean, when they were released, my one grandson, you know, ended up being life flighted back to Denver, you know, and multiple emergency visits, a whole variety of things, and you're talking about stress and anxiety that you go through. And some of you have been through hard situations like this. And we struggle. And that's kind of when we discover things about ourselves and about God, right? And those are hard discoveries. And in the midst of all this that was going on, the Lord gave us a verse in Romans 12:12. And I thought, well, Lord, this is just what I needed at this point in time. Which often happens, right? In our walks with God, he gives us a word that sustains us. And this is 12:12. Rejoice in hope, be patient in tribulation, and be constant in prayer. And I thought, okay, Lord, that's what I need to do. I need to rejoice in the hope. We want to hopefully trust you for a good outcome. We need to be patient in this tribulation right now, and we need to be constant in prayer. And then you realize that this is the times when we learn to live in the depth of life and not in the shallows of life, right? A lot of times that happens when we're going through some really tough times And probably a lot of you in this room have experienced some of those really tough times. Richard Foster makes a statement that superficiality is a curse of our age. The desperate need today is not for a greater number of intelligent people or gifted people, but for deep people. And I think that deep people are those that we respond, you know, in hope and love and patience and prayer in those hard times that we go through in life. You know, my, as I mentioned, my wife's a gardener, and she teaches me over and over again that deeply rooted plants can withstand drought and wind and storms. And so it is with us, that our depth is often illustrated in the trials. A deep person is a time-tested person who remains steadfast in the Lord. Here's what I think is one of the saddest verses in the Bible. You know, we all have favorite verses that motivate us and they give us hope. And this is one of the saddest verses. This is Judges 2, 7 through 12. Let's look at that just for a minute. And so this is our next generation that Joshua is passing on, you know, the nation to. In 7 through 12, it says, "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel." Okay, so you got Joshua, then the elders, and Joshua the son of Nun, you know, died, and they buried him, and all that generation also, the generation after him, also gathered to the fathers. "And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served their Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of the fathers, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they went after other gods." And it's kind of like there's probably a variety of ways we could interpret that passage and what happened there, but I thought, I wonder if part of it is that they had seen what God had done, but there wasn't a sense of a firsthand conviction in their lives. And so they just kind of had head knowledge of it, but it wasn't something that was built in the depth of their lives. And so they didn't carry on, that third generation. And so how it is, what are some principles that can help us to go slow and to build depth in people's lives? And I'd like to share some observations on this, and we're going to have some time to share a couple of observations. And it started with my dental hygienist. Do we have any dentists in the room or hygienists? Now, what is it when you go to the dentist, what's usually the one thing you always feel guilty about? Flossing, yeah. So I was like that. I get my, twice a year checkup, and, "Well, are you flossing?" And I said, "No." And so I went in there one time, and a hygienist says, "Bill, you might want to look at these pictures over here." And so it's all these pictures of people with teeth decay. And so those are the people that didn't floss. and so this emotionally, this caught my attention because I'm thinking, I don't want to be like those people. And then he says, "Do you know that research is showing that more and more flossing is not simply about maintaining your teeth, it affects your whole body. And that bacteria that comes into your mouth that creates plaque, that also goes into your bloodstream." It's all kinds of stuff. So she's giving me some information about it. And says, "So it's really important to floss. Now here's how you floss correctly." So she showed me, and then she flossed my teeth. And then he says, "To encourage your flossing, I'm going to give you," and so she gave me a couple of things of floss to take home. And then she says, "You know, in 3 months, I want you to come back, and I want to see, hey, is it any better? Does your gums look any better?" Because the issue with flossing is really the gum disease that can happen. So I thought, this is interesting. She's trying to change my attitude and my behavior on some things. So what did she do? And so I identified it in this way, and it's in the book. You know, first thing she did was that she addressed my heart. You know, she got me to look at these really ugly pictures. I needed some inspiration for change. And the inspiration for change in this case was the negative. This is what you could look like. Now, picture this, that you're discipling someone and they've expressed a need for, "Boy, I really need to see my prayer life grow. It's not what I think the Lord wants it to be." And so that, how do you address the heart of somebody like that? I might ask a question, "Well, what would you like, you know, what do you think is on God's heart about prayer? What do you think should motivate somebody who really is excited about praying?" See, what I'm doing, I'm asking some questions to address the heart. And so because when we look at the heart, we often need inspiration. Inspiration could be the example of somebody else. Maybe I want to have them read a book on prayer. Or I'll say, hey, maybe you could go and talk to my friend David over here. He's really got a great prayer life. And tell me about his life that inspires you. So because you want to grab somebody's heart, both a good and a bad. You can also ask the question, what do you think would happen in our lives if we didn't pray? Whoa, I never thought about that. Whoa, there's some consequences. See, I'm getting at the heart. So we want to inspire inspiration. Then head is we need some information. We need instruction. So it is with my hygienist. She gave me some information about the importance of flossing, how it affects all of my body. So if we're talking about prayer, people need some information on prayer. And so I say, hey, next time we get together, you know, let's look at probably a verse you've memorized. It's called the Lord's Prayer. And let's look at that together and see what does it teach us about prayer. So now we're looking at information from the Word about prayer. And then hand is we need some practical helps. So, you know, this is kind of the, it's called the with him principle. You know, Jesus was with the 12. And the with him principle is that in this case, I'm not going to send him home to pray, but we're going to pray together. I'm going to pray with him or her. You know, I'm going to do this with them as best as I can. And so this is a hand. We're going to give some practical helps, and I'm going to do it with him. And so I'm not going to tell him to do it from a distance. I'm not going to shout it at him, you know, but we're going to do it together. They need practical helps. They need tools and resources. And so the hand, then you have the helps. And in this case, we need accountability. You remember my dentist said, hey, in 3 months, I want you to come back. And I, you know, being kind of the competitive person I am, that I think, okay, I want her to see that I'm making a difference in 3 months. And so that, so it is, somebody mentioned about, one of the groups about, I think it was how they appreciated Richard's ministry to them. And the first time they met, how they enjoyed it. But then he says, hey, how about if we met again in 2 weeks? So it's a little follow-up. Now it's a little accountability. In the same way my hygienist is saying that, hey, let's meet back in 3 months. So with the individual I'm helping, let's get together in a couple of weeks. I'm going to follow up on it. Remember the accountability, application, affirmation. That's going to take place in a couple of weeks. And then habits, this is where we need to make it groovy. And okay, I talk about groovy disciple making. And this isn't just simply a reflection of my growing up in the 60s. But some of you who are athletes or were athletes, think of it. A lot of times in athletes, they get in a groove, right? If you're a pitcher, you're in the groove. You cannot not throw a strike. It's kind of like you're throwing that strike, or you're a hitter. You're in the groove. It's kind of like what you're doing is almost coming, you're not even thinking about it anymore. It's just part of who you are. If you're a musician, you get in the groove, right? And so it's almost like I'm not thinking about this anymore. And so part of that in building depth into people's lives is we want to trust God that it becomes a habit or a conviction over time for them. Okay, it's kind of like it becomes groovy. It's wearing those little grooves in a person's life, so it's something that's becoming habitual. And so all these qualities help produce that. What time are we officially ending here, David? Huh. 12:40. Okay, let me make one more illustration. Let me give you 10 minutes to talk around your table. So this is my last illustration. So we want to go slow. We want to go deep. And this is the chicken coop illustration, all right? And so I was talking to a friend of mine, and he raises chickens, and, you know, they sell the eggs and so on. And he's actually on staff up in Canada, Navigator staff. And he says, yeah, last night, we've had a number of cold nights, and the chickens aren't producing. He said, so tonight what I'm going to do is I'm going to go in. I need to put some insulation in some spots, cover up some spots. I'm going to bring a couple of the lights in, raise the heat in the chicken coop, and to make the conditions more favorable towards the chickens producing eggs. But he says, you know, but I know that having done this enough, it's not going to guarantee that I'm going to get more eggs, but sure is going to increase the conditions for getting eggs, that they're going to start laying with these conditions. And so it is with these kind of five, I think, H's here in building depth, that they're not a guarantee that this is going to bring about depth in somebody's life, but they're going to increase the possibility of it happening. Same with my friend in the chicken coop. You know, I can bring more heat into it, change the conditions. It's not going to guarantee it, but it's going to increase the probability. And so that so it is with these principles that I would suggest that they're not a guarantee. The Lord's the only guarantee we have. His Spirit needs to inflame and take these. But hey, if we do these, there's probably a greater probability the change and depth is going to happen. So what I've tried to do in this session is talk about the importance of slowness. Doing things with excellence, slowness helps me do things to care. And then slowness then helps me to go deep with people in the life of others and in my own life. And to go deep, what do we need to do? We need to approach the heart, the head, the hands, the helps, and the habits. So let's take about 10 minutes here. And let me just, around your tables, yeah, again, just, you know, start out with saying, boy, what was a thought that kind of challenged you or grabbed your attention from this time? And maybe if we got 10 minutes just to share that around the table, we'd have a great start. So just kind of what was one thought, one thing that grabbed your attention from this presentation?